Welcome to Dig This, NUCA's podcast and our second episode. I'm Robert Baylor, Director of Communications at NUCA, and this is Zach Jordan, our staff writer and podcast engineer.
Hey, Bob, how's it going?
Earlier in March, NUCA held its annual meeting, convention, and exhibit in San Antonio, Texas at the very relaxing and elegant Hyatt Regency Hill Country Resort outside the city. If you haven't been to an annual convention as a NUCA member, you're missing a lot. It's a great place to network with other successful industry professionals. It's also a unique event where experts and specialists in our industry discuss their studies and thoughts about our industry and how to make it better. This year's convention included a favorite NUCA expert, Mr. Mark Bridgers. Mark is a consultant to the construction industry and works with Continuum Capital based in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's delivered industry economic forecasts and expert testimony for regulatory proceedings. His in-depth knowledge of our markets and related industries, combined with his ability to convey difficult construction, insurance, and financial topics in a lively manner, makes him an enthusiastic expert speaker. Last fall, he conducted a study for the Infrastructure Protection Coalition, a group of associations in the broadband, electric, natural gas, transportation, and water and sewer industries who design, construct, maintain, or locate these underground systems. Our members use the 811 system to locate existing underground infrastructure. His study, entitled 811 Emergency, included an in-depth examination of 811 one-call operations in every state in Washington, D.C. The study found that failures in the nation's 811 system were costing ratepayers $61 billion a year in waste and excessive costs, particularly in states where its implementation and accountability are most lax. Our first guest on Dig This is the study's author, Mark Bridgers. He joined us at convention where we asked him about the study and its findings.
I'm Mark Bridgers. I'm a consultant to the utility construction industry, and I'm the architect of the 811 study and supported its implementation over a 10-month time period during 2021 and looking at all 50 states plus the city of Chicago and the District of Columbia in terms of how the 811 systems are performing.
Can you, for our listeners, explain the 811 emergency study and its conclusion?
Sure. There was a belief that there is high wait and waste time built into the 811 system that's being experienced by locators and contractors, and that cost or inefficiency is embedded in the system and shows up in the ratepayers' cost for utility services. But it's something that had never been studied before, and so we wanted to shine a bright light on what took place during that those activities and try to identify how much wait and waste time there was, put some actual numbers to it and percentages, and to provide some fodder for people to look at that as ways to drive change in their states. So the hope is that the study can be used as a starting point for investigating further what is occurring in a state, what makes a state of superior performance, and what makes a state of perhaps inferior performance.
8% of the states are using the 811 system in a cost-effective and efficient manner. What are they doing to achieve these results?
The states that are the highest performing ones have a series of regulatory rules, legislative processes, and practices in place that support streamlining the process. And where that shows up is in limited locator wait time and limited locator waste time and limited contractor wait time. In the case of locators, we looked at three different types of waste, which were unneeded locates, poor instructions provided to the locator, and then destroyed marks that required a locate to be re-performed during the initial life of the ticket. In terms of the contractor wait time, we were trying to understand how much wait or wasted time contractors were experiencing as it relates to the 811 process. Typically, that's occurring through two means. One is that a contractor gets out to the site and finds that there's an asset that has not been located, or perhaps it's obvious that an asset is there, but again, is not located. And then that would be one type of wait while they're trying to get that locate to occur. And the second type of wait time is using defensive excavation practices out of necessity because they can tell there's an asset there that is unlocated or unmarked.
What are some of the signs of an 811 system in trouble?
So the primary sign is a high number of damages. A secondary sign is a high amount of wait or waste time in the state. Our particular study was focused just on those latter two categories, which is the wait and the waste time. We did not render an opinion or did not investigate the frequency of damages in a particular state. There's also another category, which is the severity of damages. That's a much more sophisticated financial analysis or numerical analysis to determine what the impact is there. That's something that was discussed as part of the study, but we concluded there wasn't enough time to address that as part of the study. That's something that might be done in the future in terms of, is the frequency one of the identifiers of a system that is perhaps in trouble?
What are your recommendations to solve the waste and cost overruns?
So there were 13 recommendations that were made in the study. Of those 13, they were applied on a state-by-state basis based on the conditions and the characteristics that were identified at the state. The national report goes into detail at a summary level of what those recommendations are, and then each state-specific report has a much more detailed description of the recommendation, including legislation or regulatory rulemaking or other activity that might be supportive of driving change in a state. Just to walk through the 13 by title, there's a recommendation on limiting or removing exemptions to 811 membership, a recommendation on mandatory reporting both by utility and contractor, a recommendation on balanced enforcement amongst the three primary parties, which are the utility or asset owner, the locator, and the excavator, the use of a third-party enforcement board that is both objective and balanced in terms of its participation, the use of a standard minimum notification time. Our preference in the study is for the call day to be a free day followed by a 2 business day or 48-hour period beyond that, effectively creating enough time for the locator to perform the locate. Also, ineffective penalty structure. There were multiple states that could improve the structure of the penalties, and that recommendation addresses that. There were 3 recommendations that were related to one another, which are the use of effective metrics, requirement to report to the CGA's DIRT report annually, and then the use of a standard ticket size that describes a standard distance and distance. The 3 of those recommendations were linked because putting something in place that looks a little bit more standardized across the country would help with the analysis and the diagnosis of problems and that root cause analysis that I mentioned earlier. The next recommendation had to do with positive response. That's a system that's set up to ensure that the contractor can find out whether or not the locate's been taken place or the ticket's been cleared. Lastly is accurate site description at the place where excavation is supposed to occur. There's a nuance here, though, where we're suggesting in the recommendation that the use of a traditional address married with at least one of 3 different choices is an appropriate way to go. Those 3 different choices, 2 of them do not require the contractor to physically go out to the site and perform a white lining or a white flagging of the excavation. They're designed to allow the contractor to accomplish something that perhaps is even of higher value through electronic means of either GPS or electronic white lining on a map. And then lastly were 2 recommendations on continuous improvement and then on educational resources. Both of those are designed to help drive performance improvement in states where there's an opportunity to make those types of changes.
Are there measures contractors can take to fix the system in their state?
Sure. There's a couple of things that I would encourage contractors to look at. One is, first, the raw number of damages that are happening in the state. And then secondly, some measure of the severity of those damages. That should be followed by looking at the weight or the waste time that's occurring in the state and using the data that came out of this study as a starting point. This is a sample of what's occurring in the state. And so part of the follow-up should be a more detailed investigation on a state-by-state basis to validate this sample, followed by using this data as a baseline perhaps, and then making comparisons going forward. When we look at what the opportunities are, we see a series of steps that organizations might go through in order to build off of what this study has shown a bright light on and use that as a way to drive performance improvement going forward.
The study can be downloaded from the Coalition's website, www.ipcweb.org. That's www.ipcweb.org. And thank you, Mark, for sitting down with us and taking the time to explain the study and to keep our listeners a little bit more informed about the world they work in. We also had a chance to pull aside one of our members and his son and ask them about their experience at a NUCA convention. Austin Hattenberg is 18 years old and son of longtime NUCA member Scott Hattenberg. Scott is the owner of M&L Construction in Spokane, Washington, and is a member of NUCA's Eastern Washington and North Idaho chapter. Austin is following his father's footsteps and is discovering firsthand the great value of working for a successful construction business after high school ends. Austin, welcome to Dig This live from San Antonio. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
I'm 18. I'm in high school. I've been doing construction for about a year and a half now. I'm a laborer trying to work up to an operator at the moment.
But you have higher aspirations than that, don't you?
I want to take over the business eventually, our family business. But for the time being, I want to be, operating machinery and out there having fun with other people.
That's terrific. It's not uncommon for companies to be multi-generational in our industry, and it can be a great way to maintain business continuity.
All right, Austin, tell us about M&L and the jobs you've been doing recently.
Well, I don't know. I've been in school for the last little bit, but I know during summer times, I worked in Moscow, Idaho. It was a pretty big project for the city of Moscow, so we worked down there. I've worked in Bonner's Ferry. I've worked all around Washington. I haven't gone to the West Coast.
So let's talk about being an operator. What pieces of machinery are you looking to run in the future?
Well, I'd like to start off at, mini excavators and that kind of stuff, just a little bit smaller. But then I'd like to work up to a directional drill and hopefully get some underground stuff in, put some pipe in the ground.
What do you like most about the industry?
You got a lot to do, obviously. You wake up every day, you go to a different job site, you have different things you could accomplish. And then, you drive past it and you think, I really created part of this city, like in growing it as I'm growing my own knowledge.
Is this your first convention?
I went to the summit in Washington, D.C. I think that was 2015-ish. We lobbied with our legislators for Washington State trying to get some laws passed, so that was pretty fun. I mean, obviously, I didn't really understand the entire concept of it, but I got a good portion.
What do you think of our convention so far and your experience here? Would you come back?
I think it's been really fun. The keynote speaker I thought was really interesting yesterday or last night.
Thank you so much for coming. We hope we can check back in with you in a few years and see how it's going. Scott, welcome to Dig This. We've just been chatting with your son, Austin, and we understand you're the second generation owner of M&L out of Spokane. You've been to several annual conventions as well as NUCA's Washington Summit. Would you say that was a good investment in your time? Would you do it again?
Anytime we can have an influence over our elected officials, it's absolutely necessary because they hear from so many voices that are not true voices. We're the true voices. We're the ones in the ditches. We're the ones that have to deal with bad legislation. We're the ones that try to drive good legislation. And if it wasn't for us, I always kind of say this, we would be in the 1800s and we'd have, things like dysentery and everything else here, because putting in sewer lines makes sure that we have a civilized society, having water. I mean, how often are we exporting, I even donate money to groups that go into other countries, third world countries, to drill wells and put in water lines. It's like, these are things that we recognize that we needed to do, and we're the ones that do that. And without us, we do gas work, we do electric work, we heat your homes, we make sure that you can get on the internet.
At our next Washington Summit in May, workforce development is going to be a hot topic. What are the conditions in your own state? Do you have the workforce available?
Believe it or not, we've had our best hiring year in the last year.
So maybe we'll put you in the back of the room.
Yeah, put me in the back of the room. The problems are out there. It does come down to we're trying to develop a business culture where people love coming to work. And we're able to take care of our employees, do things like that. Like we offer 401k, we give 3%, no match, no nothing, starts the day they're hired. We believe, in that because we've seen over the years, being in it so long where people don't have those types of retirements, and we're trying to fix that.
Scott, you bring up an interesting point. Having those benefits for your people could be considered pretty rare in a lot of blue-collar jobs these days. When you consider what you're offering to your folks, to me, it seems like a career in our industry would be a no-brainer, particularly without a college degree.
You know, what's interesting about that, because I have degrees in finance and economics, graduated cum laude while I was running a backhoe putting in gas lines. And it was funny because people tell me, they're like, why are you going to college? And I'd always tell them, I want to be educated. I'm not going to college to get a job. And that is one of the problems that we've really had, unless you're going to do something that's specific, industry specific, like be a doctor or something. But really what it comes down to is being educated is important, but it's not going to help you in that job if you don't know how to apply it. Now, Austin, my son, he was in high school, and they had somebody come in and speak on how if you don't get a college degree, you'll only make $40,000 a year. I don't know where they got that statistic from, because our people start out at more than that are green. So I don't even know where that comes from. So I believe in the industry, and I believe it's a good pathway for family wages and families to survive.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Austin mentioned that you brought him along to the Washington Summit in 2016. Would you recommend other owners of family businesses do the same?
Yes, definitely. So we were able to sit down. In our state, it's a state that really, they care more about the tech money, our legislators do. And so I think bringing in him, he was about 15, 16 years old. And so I brought him in, and he actually was able to lead the discussion with Maria Cantwell onto workforce development and why it's important that we really start lifting up the trades again. Because we've gotten to the point where we have people in tech who can't change a doorknob, and it's good for us. I mean, the wages are skyrocketing because people don't want to work with sewage. Well, guess what? It's green. So, and I think that's a great thing for our industry also, because it provides a better living for our employees, for our kids, for all of us. But it's just a definite shift into really finding that place where you can work with your hands, build things, and you will definitely use your brain. I always laugh when people say, oh, you'll never use the Pythagorean theorem. And yet in construction, you use it all the time.
Any thoughts you'd like to share with our WeDig listeners or fellow NUCA members?
Yeah, actually, I think one of the things that I'd really always encourage our NUCA members to do is to try to uplift the industry, to raise that bar so that we are raising, as a business owner, raising the prices that we get, because we are professional, we're doing those things. And that is what I love about NUCA, is that development of a professional attitude.
Scott, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with us and bringing your son Austin to chat. MNL Construction can be found online at mandlconstruction.net. And that wraps up our second podcast, Zach.
We did it.
In April, we'll be a month out from our annual NUCA Washington Summit. Summit is the best opportunity NUCA members have to interact with the federal lawmakers right in their offices on Capitol Hill. If you think a relationship with your congressman or senator will help your business, either through direct work with them or even publicity, we encourage every NUCA member to contact their chapter and find out their chapter's meeting schedule for Summit. We'll be on Capitol Hill on Wednesday, May 25th. We hope you'll join us that day too. Thanks for your time today to listen to Dig This, NUCA's podcast. Remember, safety first, always in our work.